Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who met his wife while training for the 400 meters in Seattle and is eating gluten-free while lusting after bread, Dave Denniston.
Hello, my friends. This is Dave Denniston, and welcome back to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, a podcast dedicated to helping doctors like you slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. Well, we're doing another throwback episode, and this one of my all-time favorites. I actually had played it back in December, but just because we're going back through season one, we're going to relaunch this one as well. This has so much content featuring none other than Pamela Weibel. And she is someone that has such a heart for physicians. And I just admire her so much, her work ethic and her mission. And so I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I do as I re-listen back to it. With no further ado, here is the episode with Pamela Weibel.
My name is Dave Denniston, and welcome to the latest episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, I've been working on networking with other authors and experts who can speak to the issues that physicians face every single day. And that's why I thought I'd bring a special guest to this podcast, Dr. Pamela Weibel, MD. She is a family physician, and she's a pioneer in the ideal medical care movement. In 2004, she left the assembly line medicine by holding town hall meetings. And she invited citizens to design their own ideal clinic, which I think is so cool. And since she's done this now a decade ago, this innovative practice has inspired physicians all over the country and the world to create these ideal clinics. As a matter of fact, now these models are being taught in medical schools and undergrad programs, and it was even featured in the Harvard School of Public Health, newest edition of Renegotiating Healthcare. And in addition to all of that, she's the author of a book, Amazon's top-rated Pet Goats and Pap Smears, 101 Medical Adventures to Open Your Heart and Mind. In addition, she has co-authored two other award-winning anthologies. And of course, when she's not treating patients in her own community clinic, she's devoting her time to medical student and physician suicide prevention, two things that are really close to her heart. She's had articles that have been picked up by the Washington Post and all over the place, including on America Tonight. She's been interviewed on CNN, ABC, CBS, and has even been a frequent guest on NPR. As a matter of fact, she has actually was recently awarded the 2015 Women Leaders in Medicine Award from the American Medical Student Association. Well, welcome, Dr. Weibel.
Wow, thank you. What an introduction.
Hey, you've done a lot, and gosh, what a journey, right? I mean, you've been through a lot and really rethought healthcare. So just tell us about the beginning. You know, what inspired you to be a physician? What did that journey look like?
Well, both my parents are physicians, so they're workaholics, which is kind of a classic trait of physicians. So they were not home much. In fact, we don't even have a family photo that has ever been taken of my brother, myself, and my parents until I was 45 years old. Can you believe that?
Oh my gosh!
I mean, they're so workaholic. They're not doing, you know, we're not doing like the usual family things, going to church or basketball games or anything like that. I mean, they are at work, and so I used to go to work with them because I did not have reliable child care, probably because I was one of those stubborn oldest children. You know, I was going to do it my own way, and so I think I scared off most of my babysitters. So I ended up at work with them, and I was essentially raised, you know, a lot of the time with my dad in a hospital setting, and he's a pathologist and worked in the morgue, so I spent a lot of time in the morgue and watching autopsies and things that children should probably never be doing and that CPS would probably intervene in today's world, but I was allowed to be this kind of, he introduced me as a child doctor. So he actually introduced me as a doctor in training to his live patients because he also had jobs at a methadone clinic and the police station. before breathalyzers, they had to have a doctor on site. So essentially, I saw all the parts of society that children are not supposed to see really early on, you know?
And you still became a physician despite all that.
I just thought it was super fun. I just thought, wow, how amazing is this to meet people during, like, these incredibly transformative moments of their life when they're in the hospital or right after they've died or they just got, you know, checked into prison or, you know, they're, you know, at crisis moments. You know, I just got, I thought it was beautiful because you can really change somebody's life when you're there for them at that moment.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I just thought there was a lot of potential for healing in the social psychological realm, and also it had the academic stimulation of just the science. So the whole thing was like an amazing package.
So did your parents own clinics themselves? It sounds like they were employees.
Well, my dad was an employee and had lots of little side jobs, and you know, like I've described. And then my mom had her own practice. She's a psychiatrist, so she's a really amazing self-employed psychiatrist, now retired. But she opened her own practice during a time in the 70s in Dallas when all her colleagues said, you would never make it. She ends up making like twice as much as any other doctor in town, you know, in psychiatry,
awesome.
Who basically just wanted to, I guess they wanted to take the safe route and just feel like they were in the big machine, you know, but, you know, a result of being, I guess, in one of these large organizations is you don't have any control over your destiny and you can't earn more money, you can't do creative things. I mean, you're kind of locked down into a one-size-fits-all assembly line.
And they're telling you Medicare reimbursements might be going down. We're not sure if we're going to be able to give you pay raises or anything like that. So have you, when you got into practice, were you part of a hospital or did you start your own clinic?
Oh, yeah, I spent 10 years as an employee, as an unsatisfied employee. And I just thought at the beginning, well, maybe it's this one job. So I poked around and tried like six different jobs in 10 years. My resume looks like I'm very unstable between the years of 1996 and 2004 or so, because I, you know, I tried everything, hospital-based clinics, I tried small physician-owned practices, part-time, full-time, community health centers, migrant farm worker clinics. I mean, I kind of just wandered around to get a feel of the landscape, to, you know, hopefully to find that ideal clinic that I had always been dreaming of, that I wrote on my personal statement when I applied to medical school, and guess what? It's not out there. There's no, like, kind of slide-in job that you could just take on salary that I could find that I thought was anywhere near ideal. So I had a revelation that if I was going to work in an ideal clinic and be the doctor I'd always imagined, I better do it on my own.
And were you moving around quite a bit? You know,
oh, just Oregon communities? And Washington, pretty much.
Well, that's big enough of an area
to
get to. So, So you got to this point where you wanted to start your own clinic, and did you immediately open one up, or did you do the town hall meetings that I mentioned in the introduction to the bio? You know, what was that process like?
Well, I just had an epiphany that, you know, I'm pretty miserable working for these ridiculous production line clinics, and it doesn't look like the patients are very happy either. So, wow, if the patients aren't happy and the doctors aren't happy, why don't we get together and create a new model that will really work for us? And so I decided to lead a series of town hall meetings and invite my entire community to design the first ideal clinic in the United States, you know, designed completely by patients. And it's kind of going out on a limb, you know, to tell people that in a month I'm going to open a clinic that's designed completely by you guys. What do you want? I'll do anything you want. And I got 100 pages of written testimony, and what people wanted was just so simple. You know, putting the end user in charge of designing the services that they want, it's a pretty smart move.
And so do you think, in terms of, what kind of things were they asking for? You know, was it, do they want more than one doctor available, for example? You know, do they expect to have a practice with multiple docs? Do they want to have, were they talking about aesthetics? Were they talking about costs? You know, what kind of things were they helping to design?
Well, the number one thing is they wanted this all delivered on human scale, meaning a small room with a person that they know, that one person described. Well, I want to feel like I'm at my friend's house, you know, sitting with my best friend who happens to be my doctor. So that's sort of like close family feeling, which is, you know, family medicine. You're supposed to be the doctor for the whole family, and they know you over generations, and that's always what I wanted to do. And so it was really cool when they said, and this is a constant theme, that they want a small space that's human scale with one person. They don't want multiple doctors. They don't want multiple staff people. They just want their doctor, and to have that sacred relationship back between the physician and the patient. So that, like, is financially is fantastic, because their bench, you know, I end up getting a 280-square-foot office space, because when you think about it, there's two types of doctors. You're either a cognitive specialist or a proceduralist. And even though I do procedures like little skin surgeries and such, you know, you don't need a lot of square footage to provide cognitive services. You're using your brain. It's already like housed in your head. You could sit in a small square footage room with somebody else and provide health care in probably 50 square feet if you wanted to. I have a big expansive 280-square-foot office, right, that only costs $280 a month to rent. And now it's gone up to $425 over 10 years. But still, that's pretty cheap for a medical office space, right?
Right. Oh, yeah. That's nothing, really.
I have no staff, so that's, like, usually the biggest expense in a medical office is all the, like, you know, 13 people running around per physician. And they're kind of like a human shield that, like, prevents the doctor from, you know, having to have patients cling to them. And, it creates this weird adversarial relationship when you have so many staff buffering you from your patients when what they really – it's kind of like if you had 13 staff at home buffering you from your own children. They'd probably act out and get really disturbed if they couldn't get alone time with you. And that's what patients want, is that sacred relationship back. So when you remove all those third-party intermediaries, not only is your overhead really, really low and you make a lot more money per calorie spent during the day, but you finally get back that vision that you always had when you applied to medical school of what you thought you would be doing in the future. And then your patients finally get a real doctor and answers to their problems, because there's nobody interrupting and no faxes buzzing and phone lines beeping. And I do all my administrative stuff at home at my little home office, which is like about a mile from my clinic. But when I'm with my patients in the clinic, there's literally no possibility of any interruptions. It's just the two of us. So
you don't have a receptionist, for example,
nothing
like that. So what happens if you're running behind? You know, people just know to
I'm pretty much never running behind, because I know these people really well, and my appointments are 30 to 60 minutes, so I kind of know, you know, who's anxious and needs a little bit more time, and I schedule everyone myself, so it's not like walking into a room and being surprised by suddenly seeing somebody I've never met before who has a whole new set of problems that I have no clue about. You know, it's very predictable. If by chance I happen to run late, maybe by 10 minutes or so, I do have a gift basket by the door, and everyone gets a free gift if I run late as a way of saying I'm sorry, you know, and showing that I value their time and they are just as valuable as I am. You know, I don't stack people up for two-hour waits in the waiting room for 10-minute office visits, which is disrespectful and not at all a definition of healthcare.
Right, right. And that's part of the frustration with a lot of people. What about, like, billing, right? I mean, there's so many different codes and insurance companies and different things that you have to deal with as a practitioner.
It's actually really simple. It's very, very simple. But the problem is, in medical school, we were never taught business skills. So you know, basically get launched into a career in assembly line medicine with no business skills. So you're easy prey for all these third parties to take advantage of. But if you go in your own practice, it's very easy to understand these codes. And, you know, basically people with GEDs from high school become coders and billers. It can't be that hard, right? I made it through medical school. I tell doctors, if you can understand the Krebs cycle, you can run your own practice. It's not any harder than simple math. You know what I mean? So the thing is, what you need to do is you just cut out the abuse of third parties and deal with the third parties that actually are enhancing the patient-physician relationship. So I still take insurance, but I only take insurance with companies that treat me and my patients well. I have not signed up to take government insurance. I mean, I did for a year. I took Medicare, and I did not appreciate the way I was treated, and the amount of administrative hoops they want me to jump through was ridiculous. And I will say, as an aside, I don't turn anyone away for lack of money, so anyone who wants to see me can see me, and we work out a fee that works. But I will in no way, shape, or form deal with anyone who abuses me, whether it's a patient or a third party that wants me to sign a contract with them. I will just not sign it. I would encourage other people to behave the same way, because then if we don't take abuse and bullying in our careers and in our lives, we have a better world.
So it sounds like something where you're in control of who you want to work with, who you don't want to work with, and you're not just necessarily taking on you could take on any patient, but perhaps you have workarounds rather than dealing with some of the administrative hassles that could come with dealing with certain companies or the government.
Yeah, like there's certain companies that'll deny all first claims. Well, why would I want to deal with them if they're going to make me resubmit all these claims and treat me like crap? You know what I mean? I deal with the companies that, like, give me a 5-page contract that says, you be the doctor, we'll be the insurance company. You see the patient, send us the bill, and we'll pay you, you know, sort of thing. Like a pretty straightforward 5-page contract. I mean, I've had insurance companies try to give me, like 50-page contracts, but they wouldn't give me the contract until they had somebody come to my office, and the woman drove all the way from Portland like 2 hours, and she wanted to measure the space between the toilet and the wall to make sure there was before you'd even give me a contract. And once I passed this weird exam of my office space, which was like so detail-oriented and ridiculous, then they sent me this 50-page contract, and I'm like, well, I'm not going to sign this contract. I mean, there was a line in the contract that said, if we decide that you did something wrong, you'll be responsible for our legal costs. You know, and it's like, well, you got to be an idiot to sign a contract that has a line like that. So,
wow.
Anyway,
would you ever outsource anything? Is there anything you would outsource since you don't have any employees at the clinic? Is there something that you would outsource outside?
I don't think I can personally with my OCD personality. I definitely, from mentors that I've had, I've received instruction never to outsource anything having to do with money. You just open yourself up for embezzlement and other sorts of things. And I've also been told never to outsource marketing, which I actually enjoy, you know, that piece. And it's not like I need to market more because I have so many patients I don't know what to do, and I'm trying to rehome some of them. But and with HIPAA laws and, like, patient confidentiality, this isn't like an auto repair shop or something where there's not all the laws related to confidentiality, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I would find it hard to outsource anything. You know, that's just me and my personality. Other people, you know, there are definitely things. They could outsource their billing if they don't like billing. There's billing services that will take, like, 7 or 8%, and they could do all your billing or something like that. And you could have virtual assistants. I mean, there's lots of different little things you can – I mean, the whole fact that you can put your whole medical record, you know, all on your laptop. And you could do online scheduling where the patients fill out their own, you know, appointment times. And,
right.
You know, there's lots of things that you can do and automate and systems you can create, like, just with technology that will take the burden off of the physician.
Do you have anyone that, if anyone's listening, that they might be good for them to check out? Just a couple of tools you would throw out there that you think would be good for people?
Well,
to
I personally use Office Ally, which is a free clearinghouse for claim submission, and I've been using them since 2006, and I have had no problems at all. And I usually get paid in like 2 weeks from the insurance company, so they get my claims immediately after I see the patient. You know, they store all the demographics of the patient in their system, and then you just kind of update it with the code for the day and the date and press enter. It's pretty easy. So there's no reason why doctors can't submit their own claims. I mean, if you're seeing 50 patients a day, you probably don't want to do it, but I see, like, at the most ever 11 patients per half day, but more like 6 to 8, which is very easy. And a lot of my patients are uninsured, so they pay cash, which is very easy, and you don't have to deal with any of that. So.
Well, that sounds a lot easier that you're not seeing people in 15-minute intervals, right? I mean, you're spending 30 minutes with them.
Yeah, spending enough time to solve people's problems. Imagine that.
Well, I know besides running your own practice, and thank you for giving some of these great suggestions, you coach other docs on how they can change their practice. So you want to talk about that a little bit? How do you think other physicians could do what you've been doing?
Well, I lead retreats, and it's just called Live Your Dream. You know, it's a teleseminar that's, like, you know, several months long, and then at the end we have a live retreat for 5 days in Oregon, off the grid, in the woods, on 150 acres at a hot springs. It's incredible, so you have to turn your cell phone off for 5 days. does not sound painful, and just be in a relaxing, beautiful, absolutely gorgeous, you know, natural setting with, you know, I have 50 or some doctors coming to this next retreat in May. And so I think the issue for some doctors is that in medical school, they have, when they apply, they have this wonderful vision of what they want to do afterwards, but medical school only provides one of the three skill sets that you need to be successful as a physician. They provide the technical skills, and that's in the realm of Western medicine. You don't necessarily get the technical skills, you know, of other holistic sorts of medicine, but you do, let's just face it, probably graduate with the skills to know which drug to give for strep throat and, you know, kind of the Western medical model skills. But you're not given any of the human skills. There's like a human skill set that's missing, which is in the realm of, you know, how do you tell somebody their wife died in a car accident? What do you do when the 3-year-old child died, and how do you talk to the parents, and how do you deal with grief yourself? And, you know, it's got the whole human side of being in a profession that's basically steeped in suffering and pain, because, like, the bad news stories outweigh the good news stories in medicine, I would say. You know, there's more unexpected trauma than, like, unexpected joy in a regular day in a medical practice, unless you're just delivering babies and they're all healthy, right? So, you know, you can relate
for sure
to what I'm saying.
I can,
so the
yeah,
thing
with
is,
my little kiddo.
Yeah, we don't get any training in that. So we just, like, have to go in a room and wing it with the family on, oh, sorry, your child died. You know, like, that's kind of a big deal, delivering news like that, to have no training, you know?
Yeah.
We also
yeah.
have no training on, like, what is patient satisfaction? You know, we're getting patient satisfaction scores that they're posting online, and they're like, you know, marring the reputations of physicians by grading them online for everyone to see, but we never had a course on what's good service and what is patient satisfaction. It's like, how can you get graded on something you've never been taught? You know, how do you be a doctor? The human part of it, you know? Totally
so,
absent from our training.
So how do you train that in? You know, how can that be
transitioned? I think we're just kind of, basically, most people that go into medicine are pretty loving, compassionate people to begin with, so we just kind of wing it and learn over time on our own, or sort of watch people around us and see what they're doing, but there's no formal structure that I ever received on how to be with people. It's just because I was with my dad interviewing patients from age 4, like, I kind of, like, learned on the job by watching other doctors, but I think this should be a little bit more formal. Not everyone has the best human relationship skills by nature. Some people need a little more help in that area. And so the other piece that's missing is the business skills, which I alluded to earlier. Like, we're just given no business skills. So then we're basically easy prey when we graduate, and we are graduating as these little automaton robots and funneled into assembly line medicine, which is a completely unsatisfactory way to spend your life, which is what leads to the physician suicide. So what these retreats are is a way of kind of reclaiming the two skill sets that we're missing, the human skill set and the business skill set that these physicians need to thrive in their own practices. And I don't claim that I have the be-all, end-all model. I'm just demonstrating how one physician is living her dreams, right? And so I give them kind of my whole process and how, you know, if they learn something along the way that they want to integrate that makes sense to them. I'm not suggesting everyone go out and do town hall meetings. Some doctors are completely freaked out by public speaking. But, you know, the whole idea of, why don't you ask your patients what they want, even on an online survey, or ask your friends, or, you know, there's a different way of designing a medical practice, and our field is just so stale and lacks so many, just lacks the entrepreneurial kind of mindset and the innovation that we need. So
let's say someone opens up their practice.
Uh-huh.
You know, what do you think the first thing is that they should do in terms of marketing it, in terms of spreading the word? What's the first thing they should do?
Well, they should first make sure they're in the right location with enough people that really want. I mean, if you're going to provide, you know, bariatric medicine, so you're dealing with, you know, obesity, and you're in an area full of health nuts that don't really have problems with weight. You know, it's like you got to put yourself in the right location. You have to really understand where are you what are you delivering, because physicians graduate as kind of like a, you know, you go to family practice residency program, you graduate as a family practice doctor, and like one is interchangeable with the next. They don't really help you differentiate what your special skills are. And I think physicians need to understand what their special interests and skills are and then message these clearly and locate themselves in an area where there's patients that really need what they're offering. So physicians just don't have a handle on this. You know, they haven't quite found themselves yet, and they haven't figured out, you know, because they have PTSD, depression, and some of them are having suicidal thoughts. It's hard to like have enough time for self-reflection to figure out who you wanted to be when you started medical school, when you're in the midst of all the pain and suffering and the debt load and all of that.
Yes.
Of these student loans, which I'm sure you hear about.
Oh my gosh, yes. We talk about it a lot in ways to reduce and eliminate them. And
right.
I guess just talk about, you know, the financial transition here. You know, what does that look like for docs? I mean, do they have to have a significant amount of money on the side, do you think, to sustain lifestyle and have enough to, because I'm sure the second you open up the clinic, there's not 1,000 people ready to walk in, right, and make appointments. It takes some time to ramp up. What does that look like?
It just depends, again, on the physician. I don't have a one-size-fits-all model. I encourage people to think about, like, what they want out of life. Me, I'm very happy in a 900-square-foot log cabin-type house in the woods, and I don't really need anything, and I have no debt, and I have no kids. So it's not like I have, like, a big economic pressure. If you're somebody that has $500,000 of debt between you and your husband, you know, that both went to medical school and you want to live the high life, you know, then you have to do a different calculation, right, than what I'm doing. And so you just need to make the numbers match. But I want to encourage people to think about the big difference between having what I had, which was a 74% overhead at my big factory job and a 10% overhead at my own practice. That means if you see somebody for $100, you know, for bronchitis or whatever they come in with, there's a big difference between keeping $90 and keeping $26 after an appointment. That adds up.
Huge.
You know, so people do not understand these overhead calculations, and they get, you know, talked into these slick, beautiful jobs, these salaries that sound really great, and the mountaintop skiing and the beautiful schools and the woods. But if you're exhausted and burned out from seeing 30 patients a day in a practice that's unsatisfying for you, you won't enjoy the scenery that you just bought into because you'll be exhausted. And it's, you know, physicians need to have a satisfying life and be able to be real doctors. And they cannot do that for the most part on an assembly line, you know.
What you and I were chatting earlier was, I think the future is coming where hospitals have been gobbling up small practices and larger practices all over the place. And as people step on the assembly line, it's they're getting less and less, it seems to me, able to negotiate. You know, it's kind of like you're a worker and you should be happy with what you have. And financially, it seems to me that with dealing with Medicare and the ACA and some of these other situations, it's going to become less profitable to work in a hospital setting as opposed to being a sole practitioner where maybe you could own the building.
I mean, the whole thing is, they've created so much bureaucracy around this and made this so complicated that you need like a gazillion staff people just to handle, you know, the Medicare. You know, the Medicare guidelines, I think they're twice as long as like the U.S. tax code. I think the U.S. tax code, like, you know, all the regulations related to U.S. taxes is like 75,000 pages. And last I heard, like, Medicare regulations are 150,000 pages. Like, who could be responsible for all the little thing? I mean, gosh, I've had enough reading when I do a 5-page contract with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. I don't want to read 150,000 pages from Medicare. I mean, it's daunting, right? So, and hospitals are notoriously very bad at managing primary care clinics. They shouldn't be doing that at all. They should just deal with their own problems, their infection rates, and the issues that they need to get under control in the hospital. They have no, that makes no sense for them to manage like neighborhood medical clinics.
So what do you think about the marketing aspect of the practice? Are there resources that you would point people towards to get this financial education, the business education? Where could people go to learn more about how to run a practice?
Okay, well, the marketing aspect, you basically don't really need that if you have a good message and you're in the right location, because you should have a waiting list, you know, in 6 to 12 months and be completely packed if what you're delivering is anything that people want. And everyone is desperate for a good doctor. So if you're a good doctor and you're personable and you put yourself in an area where people have the problem that you're solving, right, you should have a line around the block and should not have any – you don't – doctors should never pay money on advertising, because it's all word of mouth. Over-deliver to the first 10, 20 people you see, and they'll tell everyone in town and call their relatives, and you should be, like, you know, packed. And if you're not, you're doing something wrong. Either your personality is not – warm and friendly, or you're not providing a service that people really need in that area, or people don't know you exist because you don't generally need to. I mean, the reason why I'm doing marketing, like I discussed before, is I'm trying to market the idea that physicians could go into solo practice. But as far as each individual physician in their practice, they should be packed with patients just from word of mouth. Financial stuff, I mean, there's a lot of doctors online that give, like, financial advice to other doctors, but keep your overhead low is the main thing. And the lower your overhead is, the sooner you can get out of the economic noose that's, like, hanging you from the ceiling there. And so it just frees you up to do anything you want. You know, if you want to go on vacation a month out of the year, if you have low overhead. My previous practice, my overhead was $370,000 a year, which means I started every month with $30,000, like on a, essentially you could, if you looked at that as like $30,000 on a MasterCard starting every month, and you had to pay that off each month. Mm-hmm. My overhead now is like something like, you know, the 10% overhead. I mean, I was making the same salary, but like my overhead was so high. Let's see, my overhead now, it's like $1,000 a month or something. I mean, it's really, really low, which means you can do whatever you want. You're literally free. So,
that's beautiful.
Yeah, and then, I mean, there's a lot of financial advisors, and of course, like, what to do when you have extra money, if you're ever in the position to have extra money to do something, but, like, just get your overhead down and pay off your student loans. Like, that would be number one, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then business skills, I think you should look out and find other physicians who are in direct patient care actually practicing medicine the way you would like to, and ask them to mentor you. The thing that really is disturbing is there's a lot of physicians who put themselves out there as, you know, guru healers, you know, can help other physicians. And these physicians have left direct patient care. They no longer touch patients because they couldn't figure out how to make it work, and they were miserable as doctors. So now what do they write books and they speak on how to be a doctor, but they couldn't even do it themselves? If you couldn't do this yourself, don't put yourself out there as a solution for other doctors. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's a little annoying because some doctors fall for that and pay $25,000 to do a special course with some celebrity doctor who claims to have the answer to their burnout. And it's like, well, what's the history of that doctor? They left medicine because they were burned out. So how do they have the answer? If everyone left medicine because they're burned out, we would have no more doctors. So obviously
right.
We need doctors who are practicing medicine who aren't burned out, who can show people how fun it is to be a doctor. Like a real doctor that still sees and touches patients, you know? So
well, it sounds
mentors.
Like, it sounds like your advice, if I could wrap it up in two phrases, it would be keep it simple. You know, don't worry about having the biggest, largest office. You know, keep it small, keep it intimate.
Mm-hmm.
It'll help your overhead, so that way you can work on your student loans and some of these other things that may happen. And then sounds like secondly is just be in a community with other physicians. Get some mentors, get people around you that you can rely on and lean on and ask advice from. Does that sound fair?
Yeah, like just have a mentor that, you know, is running. If you want to run an ideal practice and work part-time as a pediatrician, find another pediatrician who's really happy working part-time in a financially, you know, solvent practice that looks to be, like, succeeding, right? And pick their brain, you know? So just it's an apprenticeship profession, so we need mentors. And what a lot of medical students and physicians tell me is that what they've been exposed to is anti-mentorship. They're exposed to a lot of doctors they'd never want to become. That's a horrible way to train doctors. You know?
Yes,
so
totally.
We don't need an anti-mentorship medical education model. We need actually these physicians who are showcasing successful models who are really happy to be teaching in medical schools, not kind of the ivory tower tenured group that has no idea what's going on outside of the medical school, who tell people, oh, you can't go in solo practice, it's impossible. You know, well, they haven't left the medical school in a while. They're like, you know, when I mean the ivory tower folks who are out of touch.
Yep. Yep, they're in the university. They're doing some great stuff, but they haven't ever done anything outside of that. Well,
yeah, right.
I'd like to bring it full circle and talk about your books. And
oh, okay.
You've contributed it some, you've written your own, and I think it's so cool that you've done that. If you're talking to other docs that want to write a book and maybe get on a speaking circuit doing some of the stuff that you're doing, what tools would you point them towards or what advice would you give them in doing that?
I think they should just find out what their passion is and stick with that because it will give them so much energy and joy. It's hard to – I wouldn't try to figure out, like, start from the place of how can I make a lot of money by writing a book and then write for the audience. I would write from your heart and from the place that gives you the most passion and then put yourself in an authentic way out into the world, and you'll be much better received than if you kind of – some people get really hung up on how much money they can make by doing things. And if you start with that and work backwards, then the soul and heart disappears, you know? So I think start with your heart and soul, do what you love in the world, contribute something, you know? I mean, say something new. Don't just repeat some other things that other people are saying. Do something really innovative, creative, and if you're successful at it, start sharing it with the world, you know, which is what I did. Okay, I was like, really? I can make this much more money working this many less hours? I think other doctors would be interested in knowing this, right? So I wrote about it and put the information in the world, and then lo and behold, people start picking up on it. And so I think it all starts with your passion and your heart and you know, why you think you were born and to really be the healer that you are always supposed to be. And healing can come in many forms, direct patient care, one-on-one touching patients, or writing articles that can change people's perception of what healthcare is and what a doctor should be, you know, doing, you know, other sorts of events and inspiring these doctors who are really, really burned out and looking for some leadership, you know. So that's what I hope that helps.
Yeah, no, totally. I think it's this process of first figure out what you want to talk about and how you want to change the world per se, or change your profession, or change the community, and that's what you want to write about. Does that?
Yeah, I mean, and you can even look at it as like if somebody told you you could do a TED Talk tomorrow, what's your one big idea that's going to change the world? Like, what is it? Like, write your TED Talk now, even though you haven't been invited yet, right? Just what's your one big idea? If you don't know what it is, then start going inside yourself to find it. Don't look outside yourself and grasp at straws. Go inside and remember who you are as a healer.
And once you do that and it's out there, do you think for you, you know, having those articles, having those books, does that help kind of feed into the system of finding more patients and connecting with other physicians? So what does that look like for you?
I'm not looking for more patients because I'm just completely packed, but it does. I have physicians constantly emailing me and writing me because they're inspired by things that I've done, that I've written about. So it's kind of cool to have like a big cyber footprint out there of articles that are inspiring people. So, yeah, it's great. It's really great. A lot of physicians have contacted me. And then, like, the wonderful thing writing about suicide is that I have all these suicidal people contacting me and, you know, just validating them and their experience. Like, they feel so much better, and they've told me I saved their lives. And who knew just by writing about a taboo topic that you could save so many people's lives.
So it helps you to feel great and probably fires you up, I bet.
It does, yeah. Yeah, it's great.
And I find for me, I mean, writing is a release, partially too. That's part of the reason I like to write or speak. I mean, for me, it can be hard to communicate sometimes as a guy, right? Most ladies tend to talk and enjoy chatting it up with many people, and guys tend to keep it inside. So I find that it can be a great release for me, personally, just to.
Yeah, it's therapeutic. It's like emotionally cleansing. It's good. Get to process all this stuff so you don't keep it inside. So I would encourage every physician to be writing. I would also encourage every physician to go to therapy at least once or twice a month, because it is really important that you have psychological support and not your spouse. You will burn your spouse out real fast if you start talking about the things that you see at work. There's a reason why they didn't go into medicine.
Right.
And, you know, if they're a librarian, they're looking for something completely different. You know, they're fueled by something very different than, you know, working in the ER. So you've got to, you know, and I even told, there was a medical student who emailed me this morning telling me that he was very inspired by things I've written. And in order to, you know, when he exercises, he's an athlete, he runs, he's in very good physical shape, and he's decided that he is going to get a therapist that he can see, you know, that all the way through medical school, which is really smart. That's as smart as brushing your teeth and exercising, having mental health care, because this is not any sort of a cakewalk through medical school. You know, you're going to see death. You're going to be conversations with families who are, you know, wailing and suffering, and you better have an outlet for that and a way to process it. And unfortunately, medical schools have not become progressive enough to have an infrastructure to allow that to easily happen on the school campus. So if you need to go off campus to a social worker or a shaman or sit in a teepee, whatever you have to do to start processing your emotions, and I really do recommend that you do it with somebody else. I mean, writing is good, but it's good to bounce it off somebody else and to cry with somebody else and to share what it feels like to be in a room when the baby died, you know, the miscarriage. You know, you really need some support for what you see in medical school and beyond. So all doctors should be in therapy as far as I'm concerned. It's just that they have to check that little checkbox on their board license renewal that says if they've been in therapy or if they've had mental health issues. So I always recommend go to somebody that's not keeping chart notes, that you don't have to claim as like an official psychiatry visit, you know. There's a lot of different people out there, even massage therapists, who will sit during your massage and talk to you about how you're feeling. So you can get therapy with any number of people. I just wouldn't rely on your family and your friends as much. I would try to go to somebody that has some professional expertise in the area of mental wellness. So.
Absolutely. I think that's great, great, great advice. And, well, we've got to wrap up here. I just want to thank you so much for being with us. If people have more questions, or maybe they're curious about starting their own practice, like we've been talking about, or they want to find out how they can get out of the machine maybe a few years from now, or maybe they just want to follow your blog or pick up a copy of your book, how can they best get in contact with you?
Just go to idealmedicalcare.org. So just idealmedicalcare.org, and everything is there that you could possibly want on anything I've spoken about today.
Okay. Any other closing thoughts, things you want to share with folks?
If there's any physicians listening, I really want to drive home the point that you can't be a victim and a healer at the same time, so please choose one. And if you choose to be a victim, it would be good to get out of medicine, because you're a disservice to yourself and your patients. And if you choose not to be a victim and you want to be a real healer, there's a whole heck of a lot of ways you can innovate and deliver healthcare today besides what looks obvious to you in these assembly line practices. So I encourage people to stand up and be real doctors, because patients are dying for you to do that.
Awesome. Well, thanks again so much for joining us, Dr. Weibel, and I'll look forward to reading your next post and checking out the next book, whenever that may be coming out. And if you are a physician too, you want to share something with other docs and you're grappling with some tough issues, I'd love to share it too in the next Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. make sure to contact me at dave@daviddeniston.com or on my website, daviddeniston.com/physicians. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Deniston. Thank you so much for joining us, and make sure to subscribe and check in again soon. Have a good one.